This episode, I'm joined once again by Jacob Rollison, who is a Jacques Ellul scholar and the author of A New Reading of Jacques Ellul, Presence and Communication in the Postmodern World, and editor of Jacques Ellul, a companion to his major works, along with Jacob E. Van Vliet. In this second part on the philosophy of Jacques Ellul, we discuss Ellul's spiritual and Christian writings, alongside discussions on Christian anarchism, Ellul's theological work, and organized religion, and more. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paid patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you would like to support the podcast to keep it going indefinitely or become part of the community, please find links in the description below. Enjoy. So, Jake Rollison, thanks for coming on to Hermetics Podcast once again for this part two on the philosophy of Jacques Ellul.
My pleasure to be here, Jim. Thank you.
And the reason we're doing a part two, which we sort of emphasized in the first part, is that people basically know Ellul, because people might be watching this video without watching the first. Basically, people know Ellul primarily for his work on propaganda and technology. Actually, probably the other way around, on technological critique and then propaganda. And you know, I personally never really realized until it was sort of brought to my attention that there is like a whole other side to do with Christianity and spirituality. So when I got sent the companion to his works, which we discussed in the first episode, the publishers were kind enough to also send me Jacques Ellul, Essential Spiritual Writings, which is, yes. This is just edited by Jacob Van Vliet, isn't it?
That's right,
okay.
Yes.
Okay. So this is a collection of, as you'd imagine, his essential spiritual writings. So Ellul is a sort of a lay theologian, and he is Catholic, correct?
No, so he's Protestant.
Already made a mistake.
That's all right. Don't worry, you're not the first. In fact, it's easy to make that mistake, partially because in the Anglophone context, many times he has been called Catholic by people who didn't know all the context. So that's totally fine.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, jumping in on this, what's Ellul's sort of personal history with Christianity and religion in general?
Yes, that's a great question. So he grows up the son of a father who is an agnostic, influenced by Voltaire's ideas. So he's somebody who puts a lot of emphasis on honor. But he is not at all, religious in any committed way. So he says to his wife, who is Protestant by confession, Ellul's father says to his wife, "I don't want you to influence our son in his decisions about religion. I want him to make his own choice when he's older." So Ellul's mother obeys, her husband's wishes. And basically the only thing she does is if Ellul sees her on her knees praying, Ellul asks, "What are you doing, Mom?" And she says, "I'm praying." And that's all. So beyond that, she never made any attempt to communicate or share her faith with her son. So the important thing to know is that when Ellul is around 18 years old, he experiences what he describes. He very rarely ever talks about his conversion to Christianity. But when he does, he calls it brutal. he says basically he's on vacation reading alone in a vacation home, and he's confronted with what he can only describe as the presence of God. And it's so powerful that it scares him completely. So he jumps on his bike and he flees. And he goes away and he stops and he thinks, "What was that?" And he comes down to thinking, I think I may have just been in the presence of God. And a similar circumstance happens another time a few days later. And this sort of launches him on a quest to say, "Well, wait a minute, was that real? What just happened?" And so for years, he reads everything as critical as he can against the biggest kind of critiques of Christians and Christianity that he can find. And eventually he goes and he tells his mother that he thinks that he's become a Christian. And so from that point on, he launches into deeper theological studies, and that kind of lasts for his entire life.
So I'm going to assume that he was never really specific about that moment of conversion?
Right. What I just told you is about
as much as we have.
Yeah, about as detailed as it gets. He talks about it only, like, he never writes about it, but he talks about it in an interview at the end of his life. And generally, he tries to avoid talking about it.
Okay. Is there, does he say what the reaction from his mother was like?
It's a great story, actually. He says she was washing dishes, and he comes behind her and he says, Mother, I have something to tell you. I think I am now a Christian. I've placed my faith in God or in Jesus Christ. I forget exactly the words he uses. And his mother keeps washing the dishes. He said she didn't even turn around or stop. She just said, that doesn't surprise me at all. I've been praying for it since you were born.
That's a good story.
That's quite interesting.
So, you know, as I've made the mistake already with the Catholic thing, is the reason he goes to Protestantism simply because that was his mother's faith, his mother's denomination?
That's a good question too. As far as I know, he comes to it himself by exploring different writings and thinkers and the theological history of both Catholicism and Protestantism, and he decides himself for Protestantism. But he doesn't, even there, we don't have a ton of detail on that, or at least to my knowledge.
Okay. So, I mean, it's, people are probably wondering if they've come at a lull from, you know, the known side, technological society and propaganda. If they don't know of this side, I guess it's two things which will seem strange on the face of it to sort of say, well, how are these connecting? But as we sort of emphasized in relation to Ted Kaczynski in the last episode, you with an understanding of Lull's philosophy, you know it's sort of almost mandatory to have one with the other, otherwise it's not complete. So in what way, you know, we've spoken about the technology now, so in what way does Lull's Christian philosophy or theological or spiritual philosophy sort of complete that technological philosophy?
Sure. So complete is an interesting word. It's because it is because they're complete in their kind of incompletion. So both his studies of society and technology and all this, it functions as a kind of description of what he sees around him. And then the theological side allows him a critical and different viewpoint by which he can then interrogate this description and make a kind of communicative call to act freely in response to this situation that he's been described. So in a way, the point between them is a tension or a dialogue, you could say. And I think that's the trouble is if you only have one, you miss the tension with the other that makes for the dialogue.
Okay. So what sort of happens, you know, when we have one without the other in, I guess, almost in practical terms? Is there a way to describe that?
Sure. So, in fact, at the end of his life, in an interview, Patrick Chastanet, one of his students, or who was one of his longtime students and today is a big figure in his reception in France, asks him, what would happen if we just had your sociology without your theology? And Lull says something like, it would probably drive the person to suicide because for him, all the hope comes from the theological side. Whereas he says, in my sociology, I describe a world without an exit. So you could say his sociology without his theology would be hopeless. But on the other side, his theology without his sociology would be abstract. It wouldn't be speaking really to anybody. So there's a sense in which he's really trying to address his own time, and he's not trying to speak kind of in terms that are valid for all time, you see.
Oh, I see. Okay. So it's sort of a contextual work in relation, you know, he's understanding Christianity is it's got to overcome what we have now as opposed to, you know, like an ancient wisdom. How seriously was he taken in terms of being a theologian? Like, did he comment on, you know, I mean, perhaps this is a silly thing to say, but whether or not he took himself seriously as a theologian, or did he sort of step back and say, you know, this is just what I think, kind of thing?
No, that's a very good question too. He, in fact, um, so So in the introduction to one of his books, he says something like, I'm going to study this problem in this book, and it's been treated by professional theologians for a long time. And I must say, I have none of the competence of these theologians. I'm just going to approach it as a human, as a person. And I'm trying to make my way by looking, listening, feeling. So he suggests that perhaps the theologians will completely ignore everything he writes. So he takes his own theologian-ness, if you will, with a grain of salt. And yet in the French scene today, for the 20th century, he's certainly among the top most renowned Protestant theologians of the 20th century. It's worth saying that again, in choosing Protestantism, he makes a choice that's a bit atypical for France, which historically tends to be more Catholic. So there's not all that many, very many Protestant theologians in France. So the fact that he is reasonably well known as a Protestant theologian in the 20th century is already saying something. I think today, if you want to talk about Protestant theology in France in the 20th century, you kind of can't avoid Jacques Ellul.
Okay. I have this question about technological morality, but I'm actually going to jump forward one, because it sort of ties in with the story you told about his conversion, and the fact he hasn't spoken about it much at all, other than, you know, literally what you just said. And it's emphasized in these writings that it's really important for Ellul that, you know, that God can't be, you know, known, an emphasis on sort of a human knowledge of God. Do you think that's why he's reluctant to speak about that moment? Because in doing so, you know, he would be sort of describing whatever God is in terms of ontology, which would be sort of against his own idea, because his idea there is that the almost not the point, but a distinct factor of God is that God cannot be known.
So that's another good question. So he, as for speaking of his conversion, I know that one of the reasons he doesn't want to speak about it is precisely because so many people do. And he doesn't want to turn his conversion into a kind of, a kind of proof for God, if you will. He doesn't want to be trying to convince others, yes, this is how it is, you know. Instead, he tries to witness to what happened to him, to say, like, this is what I experienced. And so the fact that, as I described in his conversion, God comes to him not as an idea or a kind of energy force or like a principle of the universe, but as a presence which confronts him unexpectedly and in a startling way. So in that way, what you just said is I think right on. It's not that God can't be known at all, but it's more that if God wants to make himself known or make God self known, God has to do that. So for Ellul, he's really worried that, I think that in today's technological system, if you will, for a little, the big danger is that we think we know God so well and we want to make him into an idea and integrate God into our system of thinking. And that's precisely what Ellul wants to resist.
Okay. And is that how sort of one of the clear connections between the two sides of his work is that that's how technology moves us away from God? You know, in that technique, everything has to be on a metric, on a scale, being able to be described or measured or weighed or understood and known in a certain sort of technologically empirical sense. Whereas, you know, as soon as you subsume God into this framework, you're losing, you know, that elusive, unknowable thing. And in doing so, you actually move yourself sort of away from grace.
That's right. Okay. Yes. In fact, I would say Ellul uses the word presence quite a lot, and not just in relation to God, but in relation to humans as well. I think what he's trying to describe with this word presence is something that cannot be reduced to technique, it cannot be acted on or manipulated that way, but it can only kind of be received as a gift. And if you will, I think a good way to understand it is to think of a conversation. If I'm talking to somebody and I would say that if I could just separate what they're saying from their person, from who they are, and And then I could integrate it into my own thoughts. I could kind of know what they're saying and know where they're going without needing to talk to them. Well, that would be exactly to cut off their presence, kind of the presence of this other person in what they're saying is exactly what Alul is trying to hear or to capture, I guess, to describe.
Okay, and is that how Alul sort of defines technological morality? Is this thing which is completely cut off from multiple aspects of life? It's sort of self-vindicating.
So that's yes, so it's related. It's a little bit different because when we talk about technological morality, I think he's talking about it on the societal level or like the social public level. The place where he mostly talks about that is in one of his books on ethics. And he suggests that as a society, the West, especially, you know, his own France, but the West in general, we've got where we are right now is we are in a transition. And we are transitioning from a morality that we've inherited from the Christian history of Europe and then the bourgeois tradition of, you know, the 18th century, I suppose. And so if that's what we had before, what's now happening is that morality is bending to conform to the society of machines and techniques that we've since invented and constructed around ourselves. So in a sense, morality is in an adaptation to this systemic mode of thinking, which is not the same thing. So that's why he, in his one book, the book he writes in the 50s is called The Technological Society. But then in the 70s, he writes this book, The Technological System. And that's precisely what's at stake. It's a transition from a human element of society into a kind of machinic or inhuman system.
Mm-hmm. So the sort of alternative morality to this, does he ever define that clearly, or is it something, you know, is it once again in relation to this, you'll just sort of know it in your conscience when you know it?
No, so this one, what he, in other words, the kind of alternative that he doesn't give a very strong alternative for society in general, I suppose. Though he certainly does propose one. In his works on ethics, he's mostly concerned with Christian ethics. And so for society in general, he's more doing a negative work, a kind of, he views it as a destructive work, if you will, but he views that destruction as a positive contribution. So if for him, the technological system and the morality that is created and adapted to it, is a way of integrating us into a larger system that's ultimately inhuman or destructive for our lives. Alul's goal is not to propose a positive society in contrast to that so much as just to loosen up those, if you will, those kind of bonds or chains or whatever that keep things in that way, so that there can be some freedom to then move towards something else that we don't know what it is yet. Yeah, so for the Christian, it's a matter for him of, you know, if you had to say it very succinctly, it's a matter of listening to God through the Holy Spirit, which is never an easy thing, but it's a complicated thing that involves your whole life. But for others, I guess the best he can say is a call to freedom, a call to act differently and not obey this technological morality.
Okay. Does he sort of make it clear that the only way to do that is through God, or does he ever say that there might be some other means, or is it completely a Christian technological split for him?
So that's a very good question, because I think it's at times a little bit ambiguous. So from his early works in his book, Presence in the Modern World, he writes about how, basically, what you would need to be able to do that. So the words he uses, like you could say something like desacralize the kind of sacred character that technology claims for itself in our lives. What you would need to do that is a force that is radically external to technology and external to this system. But that's exactly it. His contention is that the system has become so all-encompassing today that The only thing that actually is outside of it would be the living God. And so that's why prayer as this call to the living God becomes part of this, part of the way to actually get out of it. But as to whether or not at a different time in history, a different force might be able to provide that same kind of transcendence, Elul isn't, you know, he never, I suppose he doesn't get as clear on that as we might like him to.
Okay. And he, I'm not familiar with this at all, mm-hmm. so I might mispronounce it, but he mentions many times, is it Trinitarianism or Trinitarianism?
Yes. Yes.
As a move away from authoritarianism. So I'm going to assume that Trinitarianism is a sort of a Christian emphasis or a theological emphasis on the Holy Trinity. And in what sense does that differ from, I guess, I'm not sure of the alternatives here. So he sort of emphasizes that this is a move away from that technological sort of authoritarianism.
Sure.
So, yeah. If you could, yeah. So in what sense?
Sure. The way I would suggest to understand it, yes, you're right. When we talk about Trinitarianism or the Trinity, we mean the idea within Christian theology, the idea that God is both one and three. And in the Christian Trinity, it's traditionally the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. And so the Father and then Jesus Christ as the Son and then the Holy Spirit, which proceeds from either God the Father or the two of them, whatever. So you could say that for Elul, when he looks at the Trinity as this, as something that's inherent to describing the Christian God, he sees it as a kind of paradoxical unity of both diversity and singularity. So God is both, you know, together, is unified in one, and yet that does not erase the diversity within God. I think that's helpful in terms of distinguishing from authoritarianism, because it's different from, for example, a king who says something like, I'm the most important in society, everybody should serve me. Instead, with the Trinity, you get Christ, who could be understood as God's free emptying of himself in theological language, for the sake of others, out of a motivation of love. So, so while a little, you know, in other words, worshiping God in the Christian tradition is not the same as, you know, obeying a tyrant, I guess, is the simplest way to say it in that way.
Okay. And that's the important thing for him. It's in the Trinity, you're allowed that division where you can focus on different aspects as opposed to a sort of singular, you know,
how
God is sort of commonly taught as this, being in the sky, which, you know, rules all.
Right. So in other words, I think it's important because if God was only one or the other, then the tension that allows for actual communion or community would be lost. If God was only one for a little, that would lead to something more like an authoritarianism. And if God was only multiple, then that would lead, I don't know, to like the breakup of the person, I suppose, would be implied there. But for a little, the fact of the idea of the person is something that allows him to kind of negotiate those two as well.
So I'm sure there's a big history of Trinitarianism, but how is it, you know, how was this was this accepted, or is this a controversial idea?
So within Christian theology, certainly the Trinity is a pretty pretty standard thing, or at least it has been since the early centuries of Christianity. How you understand that is always a topic of debate in theology. And so it would be wrong to, you know, make it seem as if all theologians say, yes, this is exactly how it is. But at the same time, because there's a, you know, he's working in within pretty standardly accepted Christian tenets, if you will. So he's not, I guess by doing that, he's not doing anything crazily radical. That said, you know, his readings of... So, for example, his readings of Christ as, I'm sure we'll come back to it, but Christ somehow as anarchical or related to power in the way that he is, not everybody will accept that reading at all.
Okay. So does this Trinitarianism, this move away from authoritarianism and not being able to be just completely subsumed, I guess this connects to the technological system and not being, you know, making sure that you're not subsumed into that inhuman element and retaining the human element, which you can sort of empathize with. Does this connect with his notions of power and violence in relation to Christianity in any sense?
Yes, definitely. So for power, I think the best way to explain what power means for Alul is he gives a trio of power, powerlessness, and what he calls non-power. So power is the ability to do something, quite simply. Powerlessness would be not having the ability to do something. But then what he calls non-power would be the ability to do something and then the active refusal to do it or the choice not to do it. Now in the technological system or in today's society, he thinks that non-power is the ethical one that really needs to be highlighted. A very simple way of saying it is he and his friend Bernard Charbonneau, in relation to ecology and things, they always repeat that infinite growth in a finite world makes no sense. So at some point we have to choose not to keep the economy growing or not to keep technology just pushing it to every limit. And I think that limit is sort of reached with the atomic bomb in the middle of the 20th century. But this is clearly linked to the way that Alul looks at Christ. So Christ, for example, in the Gospels, they recount that there's these narratives that talk about Christ being tempted, or even on the cross, or before his crucifixion. There's a point where Peter takes the sword to fight to, save Christ from those coming to capture him. And Christ says, put your sword away. Don't you think that, like, if I wanted to, I could call on 12 legions of angels right now? And so Alul takes those statements very seriously, which means that at the end of the day, if Christ is killed or dies, it's not because he's a victim, but because he chooses to accept that. And so that's a very integral way of understanding what Alul means by this non-power.
Okay. So in the fate of Christ, he fully went with that third option of the non-power of saying, well, obviously I'm the Son of God. Well, I am God and I am the Son of God. I could, as you say, call on these angels, but I'm choosing to not do that, to avoid being subsumed into your own, dialectic of either violence or defense kind of thing. And this is the third option to say, no, rise above that.
Exactly. Since you mentioned violence too, I will just say that, so yeah, certainly the Christian tradition, there are various approaches to if and when violence is okay or justifiable. One of them that we mentioned in the book is just war theory. But Alul rejects these. For him, the way to understand violence is by thinking it in terms of freedom and necessity. And so for him, if you can act violently, but if you do, you're giving up your freedom, basically. The point isn't so much to say that violence is good or bad as much as to say that it's never free. And it acts out of necessity and can only create further necessities.
Okay. So you mentioned a little bit back in relation to Charbonneau, the temptations of the economy. You can't have infinite growth on a finite planet, but we're still tempted into the myth, the belief that we can just keep going. And this, still astounds me today that people, even if you do find some form of innovation on a deep time frame, everything, eventually will end. So, we sort of cling to this temptation in a way. And I guess, obviously Alul is reading this in the Christian sense that you're tempted by sin and by the devil. So there's a clear connection there between the temptations of the growth of the economy and the economy then seeming like some sort of sin, and also the devil plays some part. And I mean, I guess tying this all together is quite tricky. So would it be a bit too simplistic to sort of say that certain aspects of technological society for Alul are simply equated with that understanding that it is sin, it is the devil trying to sort of tempt us into, you know, tempt us into something which is away from God.
So that's a very good question, and you're right. There's a lot of elements that have to be carefully tied together. So the first thing to say, I think, is Olul has an interesting approach to the devil, or not so much the devil as we could say demons, and tying it to his one of your other questions, but also to his book on the new demons. So either the devil or demons, for him, they're not exactly active forces that are external to, you know, in other words, it's not the red guy with a pitchfork and two horns and a forked tail who's trying to drag people into the flaming hell or whatever, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. For him, you could say that demons, it's a human phenomenon that takes on kind of superhuman proportions. It's, you know, he sees it kind of as this in-between thing. It's not fully external to us. It's totally human, and yet it exceeds our limits or our capacities. I'll give you an example. I think that so when he talks about, when he gives his book The New Demons, the title The New Demons, he's actually punning on Dostoevsky's book, which is called either Demons or The Possessed. Mm-hmm. Now, the original title, I believe, was in French and in English, it was originally given the title The Possessed. And so Olul's book in French is called The New Possessed, the new ones who are possessed, kind of. And his book is about institutions. So what he's suggesting is that the place where what theology would call demonic, the place where that plays out today in the secularized world, is on the institutional and political level. And by saying that, what he's saying is that we, you know, instead of, whereas in the, you know, in the narratives, for example, of Christ's temptation in the wilderness, the devil who approaches him to tempt him, you know, the tempter suggests, hey, why don't you turn this stone into bread? You haven't eaten in 40 days. And so the problem isn't eating. Obviously, the problem isn't bread. The problem is that essentially the tempter is attempting to make Christ use his power in a self-serving way, or in a way that isn't, you know, kind of in line with his relation to God the Father. And so, yes, you can see that it's a complicated thing. It's not that economics is bad. It's not that thinking of the future is bad. It's not that economic growth is bad. But it is bad when they become ends in themselves. It is bad when they become exalted over other elements. So you might say, to put it very simply, that for a little bit, the demonic temptation of economics is the subordination of the spiritual to the material. I think that's kind of a one-liner that could capture it. As to your question as to whether, like, in a way, yes, you're right that Olul is playing with understanding these things through the Christian category of sinfulness. However, the kind of nuance in that is what makes the whole thing interesting. If he was just saying technology is sin, then, you know, it wouldn't be worth reading him very much. I mean, you might, but it wouldn't go very far. But I think the nuance of human freedom and the interplay that's going on there is what makes a much more of a captivating argument.
Okay, but you mentioned there that politics is also related to temptation for Olul, and this is where we do find temptation in the modern world. Is there any political leanings that he doesn't say, or is it once again the self-serving thing?
What's interesting with it, I think that here too, it's worth mentioning his own experience. I think I talked a bit about it in our last session, but he, throughout his life, Olul had, you know, he had political ambitions and hopes. He really, you know, as a young man, he was attracted to Marx's writings, theoretically, but also to the kind of revolutionary dimension of being able to change society. And so he was really hopeful for revolution in certain ways, whatever that meant. And he was always hopeful that true political change could happen. However, as he went through experiences like his small time as a deputy mayor of Bordeaux, as he, you know, watched his political hopes kind of crushed, you know, the longer he went on, the more he really became convinced that it wouldn't be sufficient to describe what happens in politics simply as a human phenomenon. There's something there that actually does prevent what we want to happen from happening. He sees it as a kind of undermining of all the best of human intentions, if you will, if you want to put it in the most desperate terms. And so he is trying to grapple with and describe that fatality that he experiences on a lived level. And so I think that's part of what's going on as well.
Okay.
I don't know if that
answers it. But I mean, it does bring up you know, a key question then. What is the role of the Christian in the modern world? Because obviously the role changes when you're presented with this modern world. So, you know, what for Alul is the role of the Christian person?
That's a very good question. So in a sense, the Christian's role never changes. You know, from the beginning, if you will, one of the main tasks of the Christian is to proclaim, be reconciled with God through Jesus Christ, something like this. And in that way, that hasn't changed. But what that reconciliation implies or means or looks like does change simply because the society to which it is proclaimed has substantially mutated. So for Alul, in the society that he understands as characterized by technique, when he puts the emphasis on presence, he's basically saying, don't let your machines control everything, including yourselves. Don't try to understand yourselves through your own machines or works. You're something bigger than that, something more important than that, that's worth attending to and listening to. In a way, his whole theological work is an attempt to keep technique that characterizes today's society from closing in on humanity.
Okay. So now, you know, this question that I've written here, how is hope only possible through prayer, makes complete sense, because obviously prayer is one of the few things where you can finally get, you know, as you mentioned earlier, you originally had the society, the technological society, which is human, and then he moved it to the technological system, which is this inhuman thing. And God is one of the few things outside of it. So hope, you know, finding hope outside of this system, the only way to get that is through, you know, the way to communicate with God, which is prayer. So that is why, sort of answering my own question here, but that's why hope's sort of possible for a little through prayer, through God.
Yes, that's right on target. And in fact, it's worth mentioning the French title of the book that he writes on prayer, he calls it Impossible Prayer. And in fact, what he's emphasizing by calling it Impossible Prayer is that we don't know how prayer works. Prayer is not a technique for acting on God and getting him to respond. In fact, prayer is exactly the opposite of a technique. What it is it's a wager that there is a God who hears the stuff that I'm saying when I'm talking to myself sitting in a room, and that he actually cares and then will listen and might respond. So it really opens up, like, the act of prayer is a way of manifesting something that is not technical, you see.
Okay. So I sort of want to bring in probably the biggest question with Alul, which is this mixture of Christianity and anarchism, and how that can even be a possibility. So we've brought in all these things of, you know, the technological society is self-serving, that politics is sort of perhaps demonically drawing you into a self-serving way of being. And obviously you said this is one of the most controversial aspects of his work is equating specifically, I guess you could pronounce it, Christianity, you know, specifically that notion of actually Christ himself. So in what way can we define Christian anarchism?
Yes. So in that one, I'm going to follow, I think Jacob Van Vliet wrote this part of the book when we co-wrote the book. He gave a great definition by summarizing what Alul thinks of anarchy in this definition. He said anarchy is the rejection of faith in political institutions and the simultaneous rejection of physical and psychological violence. So if that's what Alul means by anarchy, as for Christian anarchy, I think it would see Christ not just as the perfect example of refusing all domination over those whom he could exercise domination, but I would say he's even the key to its practice. And the reason for that, the reason that it's not just, follow this example, is because of the mechanism at work here is forgiveness, if you will. In the Gospels, you could say that Christ suggests, as we mentioned before, he could have called for a legion of angels to save him, to destroy all his enemies. And so that if he dies, it's a free choice. And so because it was both Romans and Jews, and therefore symbolically everybody who crucifies him, everyone becomes guilty of this act of violence against somebody who refused to defend himself. Everyone becomes guilty of a kind of murder. And by forgiving this act of violence then, and then saying, now go ahead and you forgive everyone else who offends or injures you, Christ becomes not just an example, but actually the initiator of the refusal of violence among his followers.
So you're talking about anarchism. And I mean, so what you just said with Christ being, it seems to me it ties completely back into those three ideas of power. And so that for Alul and then in the Christian tradition and for Christ is that it's a strange form of power found in that third form of power, that anarchism is that third route, not being drawn in by the crowd, also not just sort of submitting, but having that ability to say, look, I could do this or I could do that, but I'm not going to do, either.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
I think it's worth saying, too, that is also... So Alul writes a book called The Subversion of Christianity, and one of the things that he's doing in that book is saying, if that's what Christ is, if Christ is this refusal of domination and power, then most of what the church is actually a horrible betrayal of Christ. So in a sense, what he finds in Christ, he finds totally flipped over and inverted when Christianity becomes a global powerful institution that, that ends up in things like the Spanish Inquisition or other typically criticized and rightfully criticized elements of the Christian of church history.
So did Alul ever sort of write about whether or not he thought organized religion could work on some level?
So that's a very good question. It's, it's interesting. He belonged to the French Reformed Church, but he had, like his experiences with politics, I would say that the older he gets, the more disillusioned he gets with the institutional church. So, in fact, in the 60s and 70s, like he and a friend, Jean Bosque, these two, they work, all the way up to the highest level of the institution of the Reformed Church on how to reform theological education. And they propose this whole project and it works for a little while. They do. It's put into practice and education is reformed and changed in a really positive way. And then all of a sudden there's a new, a change in leadership, and this new guy doesn't really care about their project. And so he just kind of throws it in the garbage. And so this disillusionment of having years of work just kind of junked is one of the major disappointments that leads Alul to just be like, okay. So eventually, actually here, if I can tell you a short story about him, mm-hmm. I think it illustrates it. So in the 70s, he does this Bible study in his house, and he opens it to whoever wants to come. And he has a rule where he says, I won't do anything for the people that they can do for themselves. So in other words, he just spends his time preparing the kind of specialized biblical study and careful readings of the texts and all this stuff. And then people come up and they come to his house, and it turns into this massive thing where I think in the end he has over 100 families coming to his house regularly for these Bible studies. And it gets to the point where he says, he says to the French Reformed Church, now we need your help. We need you to start a parish church because I basically have a parish meeting in my house and it's too much for me. And so the church says, great. And the first thing they want to do is build a church building. And so Alul finds it fascinating because in his house, he had all these families, including what we would in the US, we would call blue collar families. You know, it's working class families. This is not a Bible study just of intellectuals. But he says the interesting factor is that these working class men, they help to construct the building for this parish church. And then once it's finished, they never go. Their wives go occasionally, but these working class men don't. And so Alul finds that instructive because in his house, it's a personal thing. It's not an impersonal institution. But by the time it gets converted into this thing that's not, you know, in anybody's house, this other kind of thing, it just totally falls apart.
Huh, okay. So has that, you know, that's a good little story to sort of as a understanding of Alul's sort of understanding of the problem of organized religion. I mean, how was his Christian anarchist view? Has there been any sort of famous, you know, people who've received it and criticized it? I mean, I'm sure it has come under a lot of scrutiny.
Yes, in fact, it's funny because I think it's one of the more talked about elements of his theological works. Mm-hmm. And honestly, in my view, it's not among his best theological books, but it's still interesting. But I would say that one of the important elements is he thinks, you know, he thinks that kind of a prophetic dialogue with the state is an important element of Christian ethics today. So he models a lot of his work on the Old Testament prophets. And what the Old Testament prophets would do is they would go around and criticize basically the king. And they would say, this is where you're not obeying what God has said. This is what you are not doing correctly, and you need to change this. And you can imagine the kings didn't like that. And the kings had the power to sometimes put the prophets to death or mistreat them or imprison them, which they often did. So for Alul, that kind of a prophetic role is what he thinks is important. And so anarchy in his mind is kind of the way to incarnate that in regards to the modern state. Now, the last thing to say is when we talk about anarchy, he mentions that he doesn't think anarchy is some positively realizable ideal. He thinks that anarchy means a principle of kind of active opposition to the ruling party. So that he thinks if you're, you know, if the ruling party is Democrats and then you should be not a Republican, but at least completely against the Democrats. But then if a Republican gets elected, then you should oppose the Republicans with all your force, kind of thing. So if it changes, you have to shift your position too to oppose them as well.
Okay. So, I mean, that brings me to the question in terms of that shifting position. In, you know, this question that we spoke about a little bit over email of democracy, because if I recall correctly, maybe it's just my own bias like coming in or something, but if I recall correctly, he does bring it up in this text. It's brought up that, you know, about democracy. So I mean, this is sort of a problem, I guess, for anarchists generally, because democracy is meant to be that sort of ideal state. So in what sense does Alul view democracy? Can it work for him? And in what sense does he view it in relation to Christianity?
Sure. So I would say in general, Alul tends to be very positive when he speaks of democracy, in that he thinks it is a good ideal. He thinks that in terms of a form of government, it might be the best. But I would say that it's because he thinks it's such a good ideal that he's so critical of its current forms. And I think that's why he writes, we mentioned about his writings on propaganda. In his writings on propaganda, he says that propaganda is basically the biggest threat to democracy today. So in other words, he thinks that today what we think of as our democracy is ultimately an illusion. In terms of its relation to God, You know, I can't think offhand of his a major place where he writes a lot about that. I would say that it's, you know, on the one hand, we like democracy because it puts everyone on the same level, and it tries to express something which we Christians do believe is true, that, you know, before God, everyone is equal. The difference is that it tries to make it into an institutional framework or a law. And the shift in that form is important. It's very interesting to think that, like, the institutional form in Christianity isn't the most important thing. So, for example, we're appalled because in the New Testament, Paul, for example, he writes a letter to there's this slave named Philemon who escapes from his slave, his master, his owner, and he runs and flees to Paul. And so Paul the Apostle sends the slave back to his slave owner, but with a letter. And in the letter, he says to the slave owner, "Now listen, here's your slave back, but your slave is my brother in Jesus Christ. And so I'm calling on you to treat him like a brother. He's very important and precious to me." And so in a way, Paul reinforces the institution of slavery by sending the slave back to his slave owner. But by the same move, he completely redefines the relationship between the slave owner and the slave by putting them on the same level as brothers. And so you see what I mean? That's the difficulty, is to talk about it as just an institution of democracy. It's almost neutral before God in the sense that it's an institution like any other. But at the same time, it's not in the sense that, you know, certainly democracy is an attempt to, you know, live out some kind of equality rather than just simply accepting, oh yeah, slaves are fine. It's fine that this person means nothing, you know?
Okay.
I don't know if that's helpful.
Yeah, no. It is helpful. I mean, it, once you view democracy from a sincerely Christian position, it completely changes because you're fundamentally altering what it is to be equal. And I mean, there's, you know, there's a huge difference between, I guess you could say, technological democracy, where really you sort of aren't equal because it's this inhuman, self-centered, you know, all against all. So it's like you're voting for the sake of, well, this is the thing I want. Whereas, so you're almost voting for inequality because you want something which is going to benefit you. Whereas I guess a Christian democracy would be that, well, before God, we are all equal, you know, so we need to work from that position.
Right. I'll just give one more little thing. He mentions that what he thinks would be important would be, he likes the idea that there would be Christians in every political party, but that they could argue as vehemently as they would like to against each other in the Congress or Senate or whatever. But then their relationships with one another should make it clear to everyone else that their political oppositions are secondary to their kind of the brotherhood that they share. And for him, a little, that would be a way of desacralizing the sacred character of politics, you see, by showing something that's a unity that's superior to the political division.
Okay, so introducing into politics something that is outside of it.
Right, exactly.
Okay, then does he sort of mention how that would change politics?
Well, I think that word that I used, desacralizing, is the big one. He hopes that it would relativize it and keep it from kind of a supreme, claiming a kind of sacred or all-encompassing character. So I think that as an example, I use this example quite a lot, but I think Donald Trump's first impeachment trial this last, you know, in 2020 was quite instructive, because there's a lawyer named Jonathan Turley who has written an article where he says that neither side listened to the other at all. There was no actual communication. You know, he thought that both sides abused the materials they used in their arguments. So in other words, it was a complete sham of a trial because there was no actual communication or consideration from either side. And so for a little, that would be a great context for a Republican senator in that trial to take a Democrat senator out to lunch and just sit and talk. because that would kind of relativize these divisions that that separate them so strongly.
I see. Okay. So even though, you know, Alul, as we said right at the beginning, is reluctant to sort of mention his personal experience with conversion and perhaps his personal experience with Christianity, does he sort of say what is to be done? Obviously, we've commented on it in relation to politics, this idea of introducing like something from the outside into politics and relativizing it. Does he say, in terms of technological society, what can be done from that Christian position? You know, what is to be done about this situation from that Christian trajectory?
So, like you said, I would say the reluctance to offer prescriptions is a kind of defining element. So his ethical works. So in his theology, one of the biggest things he does is he plans this enormous book project of Christian ethics. And it would be, he imagines it in four parts: an introduction, an ethics of freedom, an ethics of holiness, and an ethics of love or relationship. He never finishes it. So he finishes the introduction in a way, and then he writes the ethics of freedom, and it's huge. It's three volumes. And then he writes an ethics of holiness, which, as far as I know, exists in a 1,000-page manuscript. And then he never gets to the ethics of love. But so what that means is the ethics of freedom is one of the biggest theological things he writes. And so in this enormous three-volume thing, you know, he kind of finishes on concrete notes at the end, but for the most part, he puts the emphasis on this idea that if I were to give orders, I would be denying the very freedom that I'm trying to create. So he kind of says, look, you are now free in Jesus Christ by this word. You are free. God has freed you. Now go live it among you. I guess a way to say it is, I forget if I mentioned last time, he uses the phrase think globally, act locally quite often. Mm-hmm. And so you could say that if he's writing, if one of the subjects of his writing is this technological society, this way that all the technological stuff is a global phenomenon, I guess the best he could hope for is to break up the global element so that people can then go rediscover the local element. But the diversity of local elements is precisely why he can't give like a major positive plan for what to do with technology other than to kind of desacralize it. Having said that, he does propose things like, look, if we were to really use the technologies that are created for the benefit of humanity, we could easily have a 2 to 3 day work week right now instead of a 5 day work week. So for him, the fact that we don't is evidence that we haven't actually submitted these things to our own control today, but they're kind of, you know, controlling us in a way.
Okay. Is there, you know, I mean, obviously there's a lot more going on, and this collection is quite short in terms of, you know, you mentioned these multi-volume and 1,000-page manuscripts. Yeah. So there's obviously going to be a lot more to Alul's spiritual writings than this. But is there anything key that you'd like to add in?
That's a good question. I think for today, what I find most interesting in Alul, in his theology, is this call to freedom and the need to embody it, but also the call to dialogue. I think that nobody today is very good at dialogue, or very few people, and myself included. And so I think that the call to seek dialogue, the call to learn to speak with one another in a way that doesn't crush the other person, the call to actually stop and listen to what's being said, or listen in a more profound way for what's being said behind what's actually being said. To me, I think the attention to the word as a serious thing and as an embodiment of the kind of freedom that we want to seek is one of the most fruitful things that I hear in his work. So, to me, I think that careful attention to words and what words mean and how they factor into what we are as a society is a key element that I would like to emphasize.
Does he ever mention if Christianity sort of emphasizes that attention?
Yes. So I think the book that he talks about this the most in is his book, The Humiliation of the Word. And if you're interested in that, a reprint will be coming out later this year, I think, in English, of the English translation. But so in The Humiliation of the Word, he basically says that today our society emphasizes the image. So many things have become images or been influenced by images. And he's not saying that images are bad, but he is saying that sometime in the 20th century, we shifted from a text-based to an image-based society. And understanding the effects that has had on us is a crucial way, a crucial thing for being able to respond in a meaningful way. So I think the call to dialogue is a call to kind of plumb the depths of what we are in a way that isn't reducible just to an image that can be seen or projected.
Okay. Is there anything else you would like to add?
Just a big thank you to you for your time. I've really enjoyed this. I think it was a nice conversation, and I hope I didn't talk too much, but I usually do. But in any case, thanks very much, James, for this opportunity.
Not at all. Thanks to you. You know, it's more surprising than people think to find scholars. So, you know, it's always difficult. But yeah, thanks. So are you working on I think you told me you're currently working on a book on Alul.
So right now if anyone is interested who's listening to this, there is a Jacques Ellul conference planned for the end of June and the beginning of July in Strasbourg, France, where I live. And so I'm working on a paper for that on comparing Ellul and his friend Bernard Charbonneau on space, time, and death and how they affect their ethics. So that's the current paper that I'm working on. Other than that, I do have for this upcoming year, I'll be editing an edition of the Philosophical Journal of Conflict and Violence, and it will be on Ellul's thought in relation to violence. So those are my two current projects related to Ellul's thought right now.
Okay. So do you, I'm sort of interested because you seem sort of, and I mean this in a good way, like obsessed with Ellul. Do you have any other philosophical obsessions who you read with as much, you know, fury as you do Ellul?
Yes. And well, let's say it like this. Ellul is the dialogue partner that I've found and the one that's stuck with me the longest. So you're right. It's a bit sad because there are times where there's so many things I would like to read to get out of the Ellul world. But it's been, first of all, it's taken so long to really get in, if you will. But, I would love to really dig back deeper into Kierkegaard and then, Paul Virilio, who I mentioned last time. In terms of theology, I've also been privileged to, through some connections with friends I have in the Czech Republic and Prague, I've been working on things on Jan Hus from the Bohemian Reformation in the 15th century. And so I'm a novice in that field, but I'm really enjoying learning about Jan Hus and his theological thought and kind of the spark that he ignited and the way it transformed Western history. But I know it's you're right to say that for a long time it's been mostly Ellul.
Oh, okay. Well, no, there's nothing, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. People find the right thinker,
I suppose. I think, let's say it like this. I've said for a long time that I'll keep reading Ellul until I stop learning from him. And I haven't stopped yet.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So where would you advise people to start with Ellul's spiritual writings?
Well, to me, a good place to start with, especially with Alul's spiritual writings, is his introductory work, Presence of the King, or Presence in the Modern World, it's called. The original translation was Presence of the Kingdom, but so it's called Presence in the Modern World. It's a short book, about 150 pages. And the reason I like this one so much is I think, first of all, it's meant to be a summary and an introduction to everything else that he writes. So it really does give the kind of rationale for what happens afterwards. But it's also nice because I suggest that you can find almost everything that he says afterwards in that book, whether in one chapter or even one sentence or just one little phrase. So to me, it's a great one-stop introduction to his stuff. But if not that one, I suppose if somebody is totally new to a little stuff, I think that The Subversion of Christianity might be a good one, because it's a provocative call to rethink what we think Christianity is and means. And in a way, Alul is, when he writes The Subversion of Christianity, he's channeling Soren Kierkegaard, who called academic theology society's defense against New Testament Christianity, which is a very polemical stance. So I think it's an interesting way to reconsider things and see things in a new light.
Okay. That seems like a good place to finish up.
Sounds good.
Jake Rollison, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, James.